You're listening to Write the Book, a podcast about books for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Douglas Glover. I've been given the advice to do shorter bios at the beginning of the show. Let me know if you agree. Send me an email. But anyway, it's hard to shorten Doug's bio because he has done a lot. So, suffice to say, this is a shorter bio. He's the author of 5 story collections, 4 novels, and 2 books of essays. His novel, L, won the 2003 Governor General's Award for Fiction, and also many other distinctions. He has taught at Skidmore, Colgate, Davidson, the University at Albany, SUNY, and Vermont College of Fine Arts. He has been writer-in-residence at the University of New Brunswick, the University of Lethbridge, St. Thomas University, and Utah State University. For 2 years, he produced and hosted The Book Show, a weekly half-hour literary interview program that originated at WAMC in Albany and was syndicated on various public radio stations and around the world on Voice of America and the Armed Forces Network. He edited the annual Best Canadian Stories from 1996 to 2006. He has 2 sons, Jacob and Jonah, who, according to his bio, will doubtless turn out better than he did. I've spoken with Douglas twice about his work, and I'll add links to those earlier interviews on the podcast site. One of his obsessions for many years has been the online literary magazine that he founded, Numero 5, A Warm Place on the Cruel Web. This week, I'll air an interview where we discuss that site and also his work as an editor and publisher. I began our conversation by reading a quote from the front page of the magazine's website. Here is the quote. "The NC discussions are open to anyone. It's a friendly place, easy to join. Just sign in on the comment box with your email address and write your comment. If you stick around, people will get to know you, and you're in, except, of course, for the usual credit and criminal record checks, birth and citizenship authentication, school transcripts, starting from kindergarten, photocopies of tax records, ID, credit cards, debit cards, etc. If you turn up often and seem to get the drift of the magazine, you'll be invited to submit. Please respect the generally high level of camaraderie and amiability already in evidence." So I asked Douglas if he could talk about the quote and basically about the submissions process.
I mean that bit.
It is real.
It is real. Well, not the authentications and the credit card check. But it is real. There's a real, a very conscious structure behind the magazine. And part of it is to avoid what's normal in the sense that it's a submissions machine that... You have a certain audience that is mostly just writers hungry to be published. The magazine becomes their vehicle and becomes part of their desire system, and I don't want that. I want a community of people who both read and write, mm-hmm. and have a high level of literacy and aesthetic ambition, but with the emphasis on community.
Yeah.
So I don't want to be used by writers.
Right.
I want a community of writers.
And that's really apparent. When you go on the website, it's just apparent that there is this sort of collaborative nature to the discussions that are taking place,
right.
And there's like a lot of give and take.
And a certain sense of humor.
Right.
The idea is, if you like the magazine and you show up and make comments and then join the conversation in a creditable way, I do invite you. You know, that's the way, one of the ways you get in.
Yeah.
People actually don't think, read that very carefully and don't take it as seriously as I mean it.
Yeah.
Some do. And so in the coming issue, we have a Hungarian poet, Kinga Fabo, who showed up. She just started commenting mostly on, unfortunately, there's a split between people who comment on the magazine and people who comment on the Facebook page. I wish they'd comment on the magazine, but, it's all right.
But can't you turn off comments on the Facebook page?
I could, but then I would lose that.
But then
menu.
You would just shut them out altogether.
Yeah, so I don't want that. So,
yeah.
I mean, people are comfortable where they're comfortable. But she came on the Facebook page a lot and was commenting and sharing posts. And I looked her up, and we engaged, on the messaging. And I just thought she was very interesting and intriguing. So I said, send me some poems, and she did. So there it is.
Okay.
They're coming out. That happens.
Yeah.
So it's not It's quite serious. I want to build a community, and I want to build a community of people who are genuinely interested in the magazine. It's not like, you know, the writers' magazines and books say, well, read the magazine you're going to submit to. Well, and people don't, actually. They just submit, and they want to be published, and they don't care in many ways about the magazine.
And actually, it's easier than ever to see what the magazine's about now that a lot is online, or everything
yes.
is online.
Yeah. But people don't. They're not really interested in the magazine except for as a vehicle for themselves. And I'd rather have a smaller community, but an engaged community.
Do you ever ask someone to submit and they say, oh, no, I'm just enjoying it?
I guess that has happened once or twice.
Yeah.
But not.
Is it all writers who are participating for the most part?
No, because there's also artists, and now...
I mean, as opposed to readers who don't write, just people who are there because they enjoy...
Oh, yes, no, there are a lot of those.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's sometimes people I ask who don't quite do well enough.
Yeah.
So that happens, I mean, but I try to be very gentle about that.
Yeah.
And they still stay part of the community.
Yeah.
So that's... I really like that. I like... the community building part of it. I like the friendships that have been made, and not just with me.
Right.
They're friendships I know, quite strong ones, going through the community.
Outside, yeah. Now, you just mentioned the new contributor that is from
Hungary.
Hungary. So, and I know the magazine has great international reach, and you wrote to me in an email, recently we've had work by writers from Pakistan, Nigeria, Mexico, Ireland, Australia, Romania, Hungary, as you just mentioned, England, U.S., Canada. And you have a new Irish feature that's regular, which is Ivid Acuig.
No.
I learned how to say it.
Oh, it's Ivir Acuig.
Ivir Acuig.
That's not even right.
There were three pronunciations on the website I went to, so I picked the
wrong one. Okay, I've got the guy who does it is Irish, so he keeps...
I knew I messed it up.
We have drinks once in a while, and he tells me once again how to say it.
And then you're working towards a regular Mexican feature, which I assume will be Número Cinco.
We're debating what to do with that.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
That's one of the options.
Yeah.
Yeah. We've got an Irish guy who lives in Mexico City who's starting to feed me stuff.
Oh,
material.
That's interesting.
Plus a translator, Brendan Riley, who we had a story by a Mexican writer in the current issue, the June issue.
Okay.
That he brought in. He's submitted
two
or three.
Which was that?
Herbert.
Poetry?
Julian Herbert. No, it's a Mexican short story writer.
Oh, short story. Okay.
Julian Herbert.
Okay. So how did this happen that it became so international? And when you start something like a regular feature that is an Irish feature or what you're working towards, a Mexican feature, does that just happen because you think it'll be fun? Or are you like thinking about it for months and months ahead of time and it should be Irish? How does that come about?
Everything happens on the magazine because... I have a general obsession with it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and my obsession is with... I don't like to be identified as an American magazine or a Canadian magazine.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the thing about the internet is you actually float.
Mm-hmm.
You know, places is really quite irrelevant. And I want to take advantage of that. And also, I just don't want to limit things. And I'm very curious about those other worlds. And I love the idea of finding writers who are excited about appearing and finding a new world. There's a guy, Fernando Strigati, who's one of the senior editors now.
Uh-huh.
And I found him, met him on Twitter, I think. Twitter is my best place for finding writers right
That's
now.
Interesting.
Oh, it's amazing. But he's an Argentinian writer living in London, and he edits stuff for 3AM magazine, which is another online literary magazine, but really a good magazine. But there's a group of us. That's the thing. We all know each other.
Right.
We all interact with each other.
Yeah.
And it's a big international community. And they, anyway, he started a magazine called Minor Literatures, which I really am very sympathetic towards because he sees that there are so many literatures that are not the major literatures of a country or a nation that are kind of on the edge of things or in between things or hybridized. I mean, he's an obvious kind of person because he's Argentinian. He also has an Italian passport and lives in London. And that, you know, epitomizes one of the ways I see the magazine growing is just reaching out to other ethnicities and other nationalities.
And will you encourage your writers to submit to this other magazine that I know about that I think would be great for you?
That's a really interesting idea. Yes, in fact, we do.
Yeah.
We have really interesting crossover. I've got a great story about that because there's this guy I found on Twitter named Joseph Schreiber. He was an unpublished writer living in Calgary, and he had a magazine, a blog, a personal blog, where he would write reviews. Mm-hmm. And then he had a Twitter feed. Anyway, I noticed him, and I looked him up, and I looked up his blog, and he really writes well about literature. And so I just got in touch with him.
As a reviewer?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yes. And so I got in touch with him, and I said, write me a review. So he wrote me a review. And then he did another. So then he came on the masthead, and then he cross-pollinated to, he's been on 3AM, he's been on Minor Literatures, and now he's in Scott Esposito's Conversational Quarterly,
okay.
Or Quarterly Conversation, I never get that right.
Okay.
Which is another big, that's a big American book review site.
Okay.
That's really one of my inspirations, too.
Yeah.
So yes, we encourage that. And Jason DeYoung, who's on the masthead, also has appeared in 3AM and other magazines.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely encourage that. We're not... This is totally not kind of colonization trip. It's not a power trip. It's I want everybody to get better and get bigger themselves.
Well, the fact that you say that Twitter is so successful for what you're doing is interesting to me, and it kind of reinforces what I've always thought, which is that you started this out of a fascination with the internet and what it could do for literature.
That's right, yes.
And it turned into much more.
Turned into much more, yeah. Quite. It is, and part of it is like me remaking myself as a person, because there I was with teenage sons who were on the internet all the time. And I was on the internet.
They're good writers too, your
yes,
sons.
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
Both on the magazine. And I was at a kind of an impasse where we're all struggling as writers with the new financial models, with the internet, with electronic publishing, and I didn't want to be afraid of the new world at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, I'm just going to see what it is and try it out. And I dismissed online magazines, so I started running. And that led to all very intellectual in many ways, because I was reading, I was looking at what paper magazines do, and because I knew people who were still starting up paper magazines, and I was looking at the conventions, and then I was looking at other internet magazines and looking at how they were put together, and I'd say, are they taking advantage of the technology or not? What
mm-hmm.
can you do with the technology? So I found that all that really intellectually inspiring.
Do you do the website yourself?
Yes.
Okay. How's that going?
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
You mean the design?
Yeah, and also just posting stuff.
Oh, I see. Oh,
mainly, I think I meant mainly the vision, the design, but also I'm curious about the day-to-day.
Well, the vision, the design is me, but I did have a lot of help from a former student who actually still publishes on the magazine, Gary Garvin.
Okay, yeah.
Who has a really fine aesthetic sense. So he helped a lot, but then I did things that he disapproved of. We're really good friends,
yeah.
But cantankerous with each other. Anyway, so he doesn't quite approve of all the stuff that I did. But anyway, the real problem with that is, of course, that I've forgotten how I put it together. So I'd have mm-hmm. to restudy a lot of things. If anything really happened to the site, we're in trouble.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, yeah, no, my son, who's in computers, is just amazed at what I did.
Yeah.
And he's very proud of it. So that's true. I did put that together. What was the other part of that question, though?
Just the day-to-day.
Yeah, the day-to-day stuff is interesting. First of all, I've got this huge... There's already over 30 people on the masthead.
Yeah.
And they all have jobs on the magazine. And a lot of them are involved in production. And I actually have four production editors who do nothing but produce posts for me. So I do a lot of assigning. The stuff comes through me. Except for the book review sections, the numero sanca, the movie section, the Irish section, those are all self-managed. They're like little fiefdoms that those people have.
Okay.
They come to the magazine, they do what they do, we're all friends. And I trust them, and I just say, do what you want.
Yeah.
And they like that, right? They can bring people in, they can foster people, they can promote people. They like that.
Right.
And that, I find that that kind of, would you call that a democratic or a feudal outlook, works well. Because it doesn't mean that I control everything.
Right.
But at the same time, I am the one who pulls the trigger and publishes everything.
Okay.
Because I'm the one that actually has a kind of a sense of the publishing rhythm of the magazine and what needs.
So it's like feudal fascism.
Yes.
There we go.
A friendly feudal fascism. So it's, that part's kind of fun, but a little annoying. And I still do produce posts myself because I have an aesthetic.
Yeah.
That, and you can see some of the minor variations in aesthetics between one poster and another poster. That's kind of fun. But for example, the next issue, we have a huge art post from the writer, Ricky Ducarnay.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a writer, but that's a great story. I'll tell you that in a minute too. But I just didn't want somebody else to do that. I wanted to figure out how to put that together. Like there's maybe 60 pieces of art in that post, and I wanted to figure out how to produce that in a way that I found visually interesting myself.
That can be hard to do.
So that was my deal.
Yeah.
So I took that over. So I do a lot of them myself.
Okay.
Still.
Okay. I wanted to ask you, before we get too far along, you know, the end of that quote from the site said, please respect the generally high level of camaraderie and amiability already in evidence. And I wanted to just ask you, whose voice drives the tone of the site, the humor and the camaraderie? Is that, I mean, I assume initially that was your voice, but I'm wondering if your editors have changed the voice much through the years, the kind of tone and the presentation of sensibility.
I don't think so. What's changed over the years is, of course, we've gotten a bit more formal, and that's too bad in some ways, because it's just so big and there's so much work that I can't be there, have my finger on the pulse of it all the time.
Yeah.
And there are always gaps and holes, and the vision is not complete.
Mm-hmm.
So put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And we moved from what was looked like a blog to more of a magazine layout.
Mm-hmm.
And then we weren't happy with that as a group because we missed the intimacy of the blog.
Mm-hmm.
So I put a blog in. Mm-hmm. So now there's a blog as well as the magazine on the side.
Okay.
But
and when you do certain little contests where you invite submissions, is that on the blog?
Well, no, they're not contests, because we used to do contests.
You used to do some fun contests. They were funny.
I don't have the energy to do that anymore. But I'd love to do that again.
Yeah.
And I still think of contests. I don't know. Maybe I'll find an editor who will do that.
The thing that was fun about them, and I'll just say this quickly and then you can go on, is they were also challenges to the writer and exercises that kind of produced things that you weren't necessarily it's not like a contest that said, send us your best work. It's like, do this, and then we'll see if we, you know, who
remember the thing, the novel in a box contest, or the memoir in a box, the life story in a box contest.
Well, there was the novel in the box and the memoir in the box.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that was fun.
And the translation contest and the aphorism contest.
The aphorism, yeah.
The Villanelle. We had a Villanelle contest. I don't know, it was just fun. Yeah. Those were great times. that's some of the stuff, you know, the total vision would encompass that, but that just was too much time consuming.
I presume everybody's a volunteer too.
Oh yes.
Yeah.
So we're all paid the same.
Right. And it's sort of like, how much are people going to be able to to do?
Yeah, so as the manager of the whole thing, it's a real exercise in crowd control. As I say, I've got 30 people in.
Right.
The great thing is that after they've been there for a while, they know me very well, and how to interact with me. And I also send out I keep a vast sort of, not a spreadsheet, but it's a mind map structure with the issues projecting forward. And I usually, when I'm on, send out a copy of that to everybody on the masthead every week.
Okay.
So that everybody knows where they fit and what's coming in and what's needed. And so we keep everybody, you know, on the page that way.
I feel like you've reorganized it so that it's really much more efficient to move about. Like, I found it really easy to find things I was looking for.
Oh, thank you for saying that, because that is, in fact, a huge part of the vision of the site.
Yeah.
And when I say I went and looked at other magazines and online sites, One of the huge problems I saw with almost every site was an inability to find things once they were off the main page.
Right. Yeah.
And I worked really hard to design an archive that was searchable in multiple ways.
Yeah.
So it's very logical in terms of organization. And when you're published on the magazine, you're on the main page for 3 months. Nobody does that.
Yeah.
So you're on the front page for 1 month, and then you go down to the recent issues. There's the recent issues, and those are the last 2 months.
Oh, okay.
So your name and your piece will be on the front page somewhere for three months.
You might get shuffled down to a different spot.
You get down to the recent back
Got
issues.
It. Okay.
And then you go into the, well, you're already in the archives, but the archives then are divided up by genre. So there's tables of contents for the whole magazine, nonfiction, fiction, poetry, and so on and so forth. And then there's the back issues page where you are on by issue, by year. So you can search, you can just go 2011, January 2011, who was there? You can find that very
right.
easily. And then, of course, there's the search box, so you can search by name. So it's available in multiple ways. You just don't disappear. And if you're if you have a translation, we also do something that nobody else does, which is we honor the translator.
Yeah.
So we have a translation page. If a translation appears in the magazine, it appears like on the fiction or poetry page, but it also appears on the translation page under the translator's name.
Okay.
I'm trying to honor the artist.
Yeah.
And every artist who's involved in the piece.
Okay.
And then everybody who's in the magazine is also on the masthead, because there's a massive list at the
yes.
bottom of everybody
who's
been in the magazine, which is now almost 700 people.
Yeah.
And growing.
Yeah, that's how it is with this show. Like, I tried to make a poster that had all the names of my guests. I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
Like, the font was so small, you couldn't read it.
But that's exciting, isn't it?
It is exciting. Yeah,
yeah,
it's totally exciting. Let's talk about some of the individual sections. You have a series on contemporary classical music. I was reading the interview with Nathan Currier, which
yes.
was very cool. So how did that come into being, the classical music section?
Well, like everything else, it's something I always wanted to do. I wanted to have more music because I thought, why, I can have sound, you know, I can take advantage of it.
Yeah, and there's a multimedia component to the site that's
yes.
very interesting.
And a hybrid art component.
And the movies do the same
movies,
thing.
Movies, absolutely.
You can watch the movie. That was fun. Anyway, go ahead.
Yes. No, I've always wanted to do music. And so everything I do is always part-time because I have a life as well. But I keep nosing around trying to find somebody who will do something
mm-hmm.
or who can do something, or I do it myself. So I was... for example, at Vermont College of Fine Arts, I was trying to hook into the music composition
oh,
program
sure.
here, and I worked with the director, and she was really helpful, but for some reason we couldn't really get much going. I had two pieces that
right.
I managed to put together myself, and then I would get some contemporary people every once in a while, but it was just spotty, and I couldn't. Then this Carolyn Ogburn got in touch with me, and I forget how she got in touch with me. But anyway, she said she wanted to try something and that she did know some composers and she had a musical background. And so I said, okay, we'll try it. Because that suddenly I thought, okay, maybe I've got somebody.
Well, that
somebody.
Fit right into something you're already wanting to do.
Right. I said, maybe I've got somebody. You know?
Yeah.
And it turns out that it looks like she's done now three pieces and she's got another one coming. So I think I've got somebody, and so I put her on the masthead. After, once you see two pieces, and you know the person will fit, and that she's got a sense of the bar.
Well, and two, it would be hard to find that person, because it is hard to write about music.
Yes.
And she does it very well.
Yes.
But it's also nice that the music's there to listen to.
Yes.
To kind of fill in.
Yes. No, I'm very excited about that. And now, of course, the next thing, when I have time, will be to create a page that will be just music.
Okay.
And instead of, you know, mixing it in with the art page, you know, that's where all the music
right.
is right now.
Yeah.
So, but these things all, you know, take time.
And then NC at the Movies has its own area. And
yes.
I just went and watched, I think it's called Zach and Luke.
Yes. But that's a movie by the guy who produces the section.
And that was interesting. And it was an interview with him.
Yes.
By another writer, but the movie was fascinating.
Yes,
it was a split screen 15-minute movie about, it's a love story, and it's just, there's so much going on.
And there's two screens, one moves forward from the beginning and one moves backward
right,
from the end.
Exactly, and the two different characters are in the two screens, like
yes.
One each has a, and there's just, and you see a lot because there are two screens, but you probably also miss a lot.
Yes.
But in a way, it's like life.
Yes.
Because you, anyway, that was a great movie, and I enjoyed reading about it.
But you know that, and there's a great story because that's Rob Gray, R.W. Gray, who I discovered while I was judging a fiction contest in Canada.
Oh wow!
The Danuta Gleed Fiction Prize, which is a prize for big prize, $10,000 prize for the best first book of stories, and I was a judge and. I just found this guy, just amazing writing.
Did he win the contest?
No. I had co-judges. It was a real war. I got him on the short list, but boy, that was a judging contest can't always be a war. Anyway, I just wrote to him right away and said, you know, love that book. In those days, I would do reprints, and I said, "Can I at least have this one story from this book?" And she said, "Sure." And then we talked, and then filming. I said, "You want to do something for me?" And so then he said, "We could do a movie thing."
Yeah.
And that's the way that started.
That's really cool.
But he's also a poet, and he's also a good. He just won a $25,000 literary prize in Canada for his second book. I love it when my intuition says, "Oh, well, this person's got it."
Yeah. I know. I was going to ask you about the rights to using something like the movie or the music. I mean, are the artists in usually holding those rights? I don't know how it is compared to writing.
No, that's a good question. For the whole site, that's a good question. Uh-huh. Okay. I mean, rights is always an issue, and there's multiple ways that rights get involved, but for almost everything, for those movies, mm-hmm. the way we worked around the problem of rights is that Rob decided that what he would do is mostly talk about films that were already on the internet.
Okay.
So they're almost always YouTube or Vimeo films that are available to the public.
Okay.
Very occasionally, we get something that's special. And he, for example, the movie that you were talking about, his movie, he has the rights, but it's on Vimeo, so mm-hmm. Yes, that's an issue. And with the movie thing, there's always a little bit of a problem, is that because on YouTube things sometimes disappear.
Yeah.
So when you link outside the site, you lose control. So there's a little bit of a problem, and we always have to be going back and seeing which movies have disappeared from that.
Mm, yeah.
So that's an issue, but. The other rights are almost always just we get digital rights for things, and the music stuff is the same thing. We get the rights to produce that to have that stuff on the site, but it's non-exclusive rights, and the authors can hold the rights to their stuff completely. Many things are published elsewhere after they've been published on the magazine. We've had books.
Oh yeah.
I actually published a whole novel.
Yeah, you said it was Robert Day's novel.
Robert Day's, yeah. We published it as a serial, and I agreed with him that he was going to try to publish it in paper too, but I would publish it as a serial, and I said, if you got a publisher, I would take it down.
Okay.
Except for the first chapter. And that's what happened. So he got a publisher, I took it down, it was the first chapter.
Okay. So it's no longer in the archives because of the rights.
Right. The first chapter is in the archives, and then, you know, a note saying that it's been published here.
Yeah.
You can buy it.
You're listening to Write the Book. Today's guest is Douglas Glover, author and founder of the literary magazine Numero Cinque, A Warm Place on the Cruel Web.
Okay, I want to ask you a craft question that came out of my having a look at the site this week. One of the pieces that you had on recently is about Lish, Gordon Lish, and Jason Lucarelli wrote
yes.
the piece, right? And we don't have time to go deeply into the literary theory of consecution, but I want to just read an excerpt so that we can talk about it.
Okay.
Is that okay?
That's a long time ago, but yes.
Okay.
But read it.
It was interesting. It's very much tied into your way of thought, I think, as well.
Yes.
So this is a quote from Lish. Examine your objects for the tension inherent in them, the polarity, the natural conflict, the innate conflict, what is already there. And in the unpacking of this tension, you will reveal the whole of your story and how each unpacked object relates in the story to every other object. And you talk a lot about this sort of thing in your book, Attack of the Copula Spiders. So if I were just to ask a simple question about all of this, I would want to know, at what point in the act of writing a story or a novel do you consider these questions? I should probably mention your quote too. Stories have a liner component based on the forward movement of plot and time, but the stuff, the textured density of material draped over this bare bone of plot, often takes on a churning, recursive quality.
Yes.
Words, thematic topics or motifs, images and memories start up and then recycle through the story, coming back again and again with variation. So are these first draft questions, or it's a kind of simple question, but I am curious, like, do you think about this when you're writing a first draft, or is this more a part of your revision process to think about these questions?
Oh, I think about it completely on the first draft.
I mean, you do?
Yeah. In fact, I usually tend to write about one draft, mainly because I move forward very gradually.
You've got forward, back, forward, back, forward, back?
Right,
or,
yeah. Right. And,
okay.
But based on, basically, those two quotes are in many ways quite parallel.
Yes.
You're right to pick them like that.
I think actually it was Jason who picked them like that.
Jason picked them, yes. Jason's a very smart man. When you ask me how those things, and it's very much a first draft, but I think that, you know, when you're learning, it's not necessarily a first draft thing, but after you've learned a lot of techniques, that once you've learned them and internalized them, then they become part of your, you know, your become almost instinctive for you. So,
yes.
You know, going with that, what's not in that quotation is Lish's concept of the attack sentence, which is usually the first sentence of the story, which is a sentence that could be very crisp and lean, but in the unpacking of the tensions within that sentence, the story evolves. And I'm very much a first sentence writer. The story evolves out of the first sentence or two.
And you're not even talking necessarily about the hook that people talk about where you grab the reader. It's
no.
More just that the story evolves or emerges from that.
Out of the tension that you write into that initial sentence. So, I mean, this is almost a spiel from what I do in workshop all the time, but I used to actually just write the first sentences of stories without having any idea of what the story was. That is, I just knew I would write and have some people in some sort of tension with themselves or with each other. And so I have stories that start up. One story is, I am in bed with a woman who looks like a movie star and I have lost my memory.
Hmm.
Now, that's a story called A Guide to Animal Behavior, but...
Which was the title of the book.
Right.
Right.
But I had no idea where that was going. The unpacking of the first sentence, that's the way Lish talks. But to me, it's the implications of the first sentence, where you go from that thing. You know that you've got the woman and the guy, and he's lost his memory. And
she may or may not be a movie star.
She may or may not be a movie star, but she looks like one, and she isn't in the end. She sells real estate. But the unpacking of that, the mystery and the focus on just that is what drives the sentence after sentence. So I'm
right.
A sentence writer, right? You write the first sentence, then you write the next sentence. And you have to be surprising and interesting, but you have to refer back to the first sentence.
Yes.
You just evolve that way. And that's sort of the essence of what he's saying in terms of consecution.
Okay.
You know, and I think that he learned it from, you know, I couldn't say this for sure, but he's very much a modernist. What he's saying is very much what Gertrude Stein did as a writer.
Okay.
And you can watch Gertrude Stein evolving sentence after sentence.
Yeah.
That way.
Yeah.
So, Lish is very interesting theoretically, and he's coming into his own as a kind of theoretician and critic. There are people studying him.
Right.
Amongst them, Lucarelli. But Lucarelli, I got Lucarelli doing this. He was my student, right?
Yeah.
And now he's been on panels about Lish, and he's in touch with a guy in England who's writing a book about Lish, and who writes for 3 AM magazine. All this stuff
interweave.
You can't see, this is an audio interview, so you can't see my hands interweaving.
Right, yeah.
And that to me is just fascinating. Just at a certain point, I knew all these people, and I was seeing their names on Twitter and different sites, and I started making a mind map of this internet literary world that I was entering with all the names and the sites and how they were interrelated. It's just fascinating.
It is, yeah.
But the energy, the mental and intellectual energy that is out there, you can get so depressed about publishing and the decline of the book or whatever you want to get depressed about, commercial marketing, everything. There's so much depressing stuff. But what this magazine has done is opened up a world of incredibly energetic people who are absolutely committed to putting words on the page. Mm. And with the highest standards imaginable, you know, the real ambition. And it's not commercial ambition. It's wanting to be smart.
Yeah.
And that's just, in the last 6 years, has opened up a world to me.
Yeah.
You know, I want to be smart, these people say, you know. And I want to talk to smart people. I don't want to talk to the Trumpites.
Yeah. Right.
You know? And that's so exciting.
And I don't want my work to just satisfy people who are looking for what they have seen before.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to excite my friends, you know, on this world, this larger world.
Yeah.
And that just is so much fun.
I want to ask one more of my questions, and then I'm going to ask you to come up with something that you want to talk about the magazine,
if you would like.
But there's an interview that I read. Natalie Helberg conducts an interview with Joanna Walsh, the writer Joanna Walsh, and this is just a quote from this, but I thought it was interesting. As an interviewer, I thought this was interesting. She says, I'm very obliging, far too ready to create theories around my writing in response to questions, like a patient who's ready to talk about herself in the third person with her doctor. And this is tempting, but it's also dangerous. She could die from it. As an interviewer, I loved this, and I recognize the impulse because a lot of writers feel this way. And I wondered how you react to the idea that we can embrace unexpected theories about our writing given the right question.
Oh, well, obviously, I think I absolutely agree with that. What's interesting is what I always, because I'm a very paranoid, defensive person, right?
Okay.
So I think of it.
I'm not going to agree with that.
Good, thank you. Well, this is a good conversation. But that's actually a really smart question.
Good.
But I've always thought of it in the opposite way. I mean, she was very nice and gentle about it.
Yeah.
Northrop Frye, the great Canadian critic, once said that, you know, to answer a question is to ratify the assumptions of the question.
Yes.
And so generally speaking in interviews, I always don't answer the question.
Okay.
So
you try to sidestep, or you
absolutely
try to take it in?
I just naturally sidestep it. My son Jonah just kills himself laughing when he sees me interviewed because he says, you never answer the question. And that's exactly, I mean, what she's saying is that the question creates the context, creates the theory. The question assumes a theory.
Right.
And if you answer the question, you enter the theory. And then you could be somebody
confirm
other
it.
Than yourself.
Yeah.
And but, of course, that's just not an issue with interviews. That's
an issue with language.
With language, with interpersonal communication at any level.
Right.
We are always engaging with other people's theory and assumptions. In love, it's the whole situation with love is that you commit yourself to somebody else's theory.
Yeah.
And that could be trouble. You could become somebody else in that. So that's
okay,
an essential quote. That's great.
That's very interesting. I'm curious if you ever are asked a question that you go, oh, wait, actually, that's cool. And I agree with it about my work, and I haven't thought about that before. Or does that not happen too much?
No, that could happen and does happen. I mean, I'm certainly available. I would say less. I mean, I can't. You know, this is all oral. I can't remember conversations very far back. But it certainly happens when I'm reading critics who are talking about me.
Okay.
Where people, and generally academic critics have been, I found to be very intelligent and enthusiastic readers of my work,
mm-hmm.
and they have said things that frame things in ways that I hadn't thought about them.
That you find interesting.
That I find quite interesting.
Whether or not you want to say that's what it is.
Right. No. But I don't say that's what it is about anything.
Yeah.
I'm very much a guy who says theory is a tool, not a substance, not a not an essence.
Yeah, not a truth.
I love theory because it might... No, it's not whether it's the theory is true or not. It's just how many possibilities it will engage.
Okay.
So the more breadth and interest the theory can dig out of a work, the more I like it.
Okay.
So whether it's true or not doesn't matter.
Okay. Now, I want to... Is there something in particular you'd like to talk about that we haven't talked about yet before I get to my last question?
It's two things.
Two things. Go.
Sorry. And no. They're the opposite poles, because I want to get the opposite poles.
That's fine.
Okay. The one is that it's a French philosopher, Pierre Bourdieu. Okay. Bourdieu. B-O-U-R-D-I-E-A-U. Did I get it right? Yeah, I think so. He's very much in the back of my mind.
All right.
Okay. And I probably screw up his philosophy, you know, anyway, but... He has this theory of cultural capital and symbolic capital.
Mm-hmm.
He's part Marxist, part sociologist, part philosopher, right? And it's very much at the back of what I do with this magazine. I see very much as an intellectual and symbolic capital that I am amassing and spending to get more.
Mm-hmm.
Culture is a kind of game. And aesthetics have to do with power and class. And we started the magazine as sort of an outsider group. It's named after a fictional terrorist group in a short story of mine.
Ah.
We thought of ourselves as piratical outsiders who just had fun, but were smart. That's the original group.
Okay.
And we had fun with that idea. But we've parlayed that. Outsiders, that gives you a certain amount of cultural capital. I myself, as a writer of a certain standing, have a certain cultural capital.
Okay.
And what we've done is we've traded on the capital that we have to bring in artists.
Yes.
And we try to bring artists that are a step above, and we use that capital to bring in artists that are a step above.
Right.
Nobody gets paid here.
Yeah.
It's a kind of, there is a, but there's an invisible message system of value.
Yeah.
That I'm quite consciously using to make the magazine bigger. And I think that early on people tended to dismiss the magazine as just a blog without understanding that there was this sort of vision of a feedback system that was going to make it grow, you know, irrespective of the fact whether there's money involved. And I wanted it to be outside this system of money. I didn't want ads. I didn't want to be trying to make money. I didn't want it to be a non-profit. I didn't want it to have subventions from a college.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted it to be free and build on its own power.
Okay.
So there's a real conscious thing going on. And Natalie Helberg is one of my... I love that girl. She's doing a PhD in Toronto now, but she identified with the magazine right away because she saw it as a kind of anti-capitalist outside the system.
Yeah.
I think she recognized it. And that's what I want people to recognize.
Okay.
It's a community, but it has a really interesting purpose.
Okay.
Okay, that's one thing. But then on the...
That actually ties to my last question, but go ahead.
Okay, but then on the personal side, there's such a personal... I'm touched about every 4 months, touched to my heart by things that happen in the magazine. So this is one.
Okay.
I have a writer on the masthead, Jeff Bersey, and he has some contacts. And he had this American writer, Sam Savage, that he'd done some pieces on, and he said, would I like an interview? And I said, sure. Sam is really an interesting experimental writer with one book that did very well, but not very well known. He did a marvelous, long, life-encompassing interview, and we published it, and it was just great. And then about 3 months later, Jeff writes to me, and he says, you know, Sam is dying.
Mm.
And he said, we should do something. And I said, okay, let's work on it. So he said, you write something. So he wrote something. And he said, where is Sam? I mean, could we maybe get something to go with this? And he said, yeah, well, I'll ask him. And so Sam wrote and said he had some poems. And I said, oh, that'd be great, because he writes fiction. So then... Jeff said, well, he's actually got a whole book of his collected poems that he so far hasn't been able to get a publisher for, and time is running short. And I said, we'll send them. I'll look at them, and we'll pick some. So I looked at them and I wrote back and I said, you know, tell Sam I'll publish the whole book if he wants that.
Oh, wow.
And we did.
In the...
The whole collected poems.
Oh, wow.
Came up. And then he gave us a short story.
Oh, wow.
And there's the poor guy. I mean, I'm really... This is... I mean, it's a great story, but it's a very sad story. But it just did me a lot of good to be able to do something. And it's...
To be in that position, to be able to say, and, hey, let's do this thing.
But more important, I mean, they're really great poems.
Sure.
And like David Wojahn, who saw them and just sort of wrote a spontaneous review, which then I published.
Oh, yeah.
And he's, you know, sees them as a great discovery.
Yeah.
And I think they didn't get published very much because he's seen mainly as a prose writer, and it's sort of hard to break into the poetry writing scene if you're seen as something else. But to be able to do things for people and to meet them in the magazine at emotional moments in their lives has been tremendously enlivening for me.
Yeah. So this is the question that was maybe tied in a little bit with the first half of your answer, which is you created NC for the literary community, Numero Sank. I'm always afraid I'm going to say that wrong because I don't speak French, but Sank. I presume you sort of created it for creating a community, but also for the literary community that existed before you started it. And it's a lot of work to run such an incredible site. I wondered if you could maybe offer some advice for writers who consider founding magazines, presses, podcasts, writing conferences, whatever, with the goal of becoming better literary citizens and giving something back. Do you have advice for people who are considering that kind of move?
I'm not sure. I guess I do. I mean, I have a lot of advice, but mainly I think, you know, that's actually a very good thing.
Yeah.
And one of the things that was in the back of my mind was that I felt like there was an upwelling of sort of literary magazines online when we started out, and that was a good thing. But I remember when I was younger in the 60s and the early 70s that there was a lot of, you know, basically very small magazines that were just proliferating everywhere. And that was exciting, and then I felt like that kind of disappeared, and everybody became sort of, you know, well, we have to have a university magazine, and it has to be paid for, and we have to get the money, and we lost a sense of a kind of rebellious bubbling of life that comes from just starting a magazine, and, you know, samizdat, right? You write it out, or you type it out, and staple it, and give it to your friends.
Right.
And I wanted to come back to that.
The internet sort of gave us that possibility
again. It's cheap, and also you can disseminate things very widely. The trouble is when you on the internet, it's getting people to look at you, and so that's and again, it's another science, another art maybe rather than a science, and that's and a whole other aspect of the magazine is figuring out how to get people to come to it, how to get the readership going up.
Thank you, Douglas.
Thank you very much.
Wonderful.
Yeah, this is fun.
This week's Write the Book prompt, generously suggested by my guest Douglas Glover, is an aphoristic Mad Lib. Doug began studying aphorisms early in his writing career once he realized what they were and how they were used by certain writers who he admired. This is from the Numero Sank website. Generally speaking, aphorisms are terse, pointed sayings meant to provoke thought and argument. There are several basic types, but they often set up as definitions or clever, balanced antitheses or even puns. Doug recommends approaching the aphorism as a formal experiment. Decide which type appeals to you, sit down, and write some. Don't just write one, write many. Don't spend a lot of time on them, play with them and see what happens. And definitely don't think about what you mean ahead of time. The exercise is meant to be an act of discovery. After you've written some, play with putting them into thematic passages in your work. For example, if you have a scene where a husband and wife are fighting, you can insert a love aphorism. Here is one that Douglas Glover wrote in his short story, Bad News of the Heart. And what is love? An erotic accident prolonged to disaster. If you have a scene where you want to compare and contrast two types of people, here's an example from Doug. He sent this in an email to a recalcitrant student. There are two kinds of readers, the adventurers who glory in the breathtaking audacity and risk of a well-turned aphorism, and the weenies who, lacking courage themselves, find it an affront in others. Here's one that I wrote for a Numero Sank aphorism contest back in the days when Numero Sank had contests. Truth prowls in mansions of wit. So, to start, just play around with these types. The definition, blank is blank. The two kinds. There are two kinds of blank. The blank and the blank. I'll include a link on the podcast site to a PDF that Douglas Glover wrote about the aphorism in case you'd like to read more about this. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Also, do let me know if you liked the longer bios, if you prefer shorter bios for my guests. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book, which comes to you from Burlington, Vermont.